Welcome to the Farcast, bringing you insights into Wall Street, Washington, and the world. Now here's your host, Michael Farr.
Welcome to the Farcast. I am Michael Farr. Thanks so much for joining us again this week. It is the fourth day of April, the first quarter of 2024. It's in the books. And wow, what a good year it was. It was a great year in the first quarter. Up 10% for the S&P. Pretty much same for the NASDAQ. Not so much for the Dow, 5%. Hey, if I offered you 5% in the first quarter on January 1st, tell me which one of you wouldn't have taken that. I'm telling you, I would have taken it in a heartbeat. Well, good thing, because I got it. And I didn't get the full 10% for the S&P, and I didn't own enough of the weighting of those things that keep surging up. The Magnificent Seven has turned into the Fab Four. So that tech leadership narrowed during the quarter, while performance for the overall broader S&P 500 index actually broadened out. So where are we today? Are we in a transition, or are we going to see more of the same? Sam Stovall, who really looks at a lot of historical data, I've known Sam for years, as have most of all of my talking head buddies. We all know each other. Sam's numbers have always been very interesting and often correct. That's the best. That's high praise when you're a talking head. Always interesting and sometimes correct. Sam says, based on history, when you see this sort of a start to the year, you should see 2 points of volatility. This is wild stuff. 2 points of volatility, 5 to 10%, could be over 10%. End the year north of 20%. Okay, I can get through that. I could take that if that's what happens. But Sam Stovall has a bullish ending on this year. Well, we've got a 10% gain of the house's money to play with over the next three quarters. That's number one. Years ago, folks, I was meeting with a trust department guy who had been working in a trust department in Boston forever, because I'd just taken over his son's accounts, and his daughters wanted to move to me. And I showed him his son's accounts that had done very well, and they had more tech names and things. And this was in the 90s. And this guy got upset and he goes, well, he had them invested in like a 60-40 account for his 20-something-year-old kids. And they had done much better. My accounts had done 2-to-1 what his accounts had done working for his kids. Well, he had bonds and conservative stuff. And he said, wow, your accounts aren't going to do, if we hit a rough patch, he said, your accounts are really going to go down. And I said, well, they're going to go down from a twice as high point as your accounts. I can go down from twice as high, and your kids can have that volatility. And that indeed was the whole point. So where are we now? Kind of a rocky start to the beginning of the quarter. 10-year treasury yield has surged, which means that price has dropped. Oil is edging up, but not as much as I thought, given what's going on in the Middle East. $85 a barrel oil doesn't bug me too much. Dollar has been holding in tight, and I think if you look at gold, gold is the canary in the coal mine here, and I think it's what we all have to watch. And the monetization, or the price of gold, I think really has to do with the market's opinion of whether the Fed can control the long end. If they lose control of the long end of the yield curve, that 20 to 30, 15 to 30, I don't care what you want to call the long end, the Fed can make short-term moves and adjust short-term rates. It takes a lot more dollars to control those long-term rates, and they've never really shown they can do it, but in fits and spurts. So, watch what the market's telling you. We got above $2,300 an ounce gold. If the market gets nervous, I could see that going to $3,000 an ounce. I can. So, will they control inflation? We're at 3%. Will there be a surge in demand? Will we still have a recession? What's going to happen? We turn to our friend Jim Murio, TJM Institutional Services, the voice of the Chicago Exchange and floor, and our great friend. Hey, Jim, welcome.
Thank you, Michael. How are you?
I'm great. Sorry for the windy beginning, but I had a lot to
No, I
cover
did.
here.
No, I took a solid nap, then I had some coffee. It was great.
Did you? Oh, that's wonderful. I bet half of our listeners just did too. Waiting for you. Hey, Farr, shut up and let Yurio talk.
I'm kidding. It was great. I agree with most of what you said. I'm glad that you hit on gold. What happened on March 20th, when the chairman came out and gave that speech where he said his expectations for GDP are higher, his expectations for PCE inflation are higher, and at the same time, he still said he was planning on cutting three times 75 basis points in 2024. The market took that to mean explicitly that he has abandoned the 2% inflation target, and now that target that he's willing to accept is something significantly higher. I don't know why. I think it's 2.7 to 2.9. That's just kind of the thumbnail from what I'm hearing him say, and that's why gold rallied. That's why silver. Did you see silver, by the way, starting to play catch up as of 2 days ago? Copper's rallying. Crude is rallying too. All those things do well in an environment where they're willing to allow for a little more inflation. When you mentioned the long end, I think that's fascinating because I've been long steepeners for the last couple months, meaning I think long end rates are going higher. And that to me is a function of the government is going to have to sell a lot of those bonds to depress the price. Which, by the way, now what I've been saying for the last 6 months, and I think you can testify to this, is that not only did I like gold, silver, copper, and oil, I still like stocks, particularly when they're giving away options for hedges, particularly when there's opportunities to rebalance after you've made a lot of money. I do think that there will be a 8 to 10% correction this year. There is many years. And I think I have a pretty good idea what's going to cause, and that's going to be like fissures in the banking system as it relates to a commercial real estate. And I think those things could surface in a couple months. It could be coincidental with the same time the money in the reverse repo system, which is we've talked about in this show before, and I don't want to get too deep in the weeds, but that's what's providing liquidity for the treasury. They sell those bonds on the short end, the 3 month, and then they inject them into the economy. And that's what's buoying all these assets. So I do think the stocks will be the one thing that'll crack this year, but those other things I like for the whole year.
Bank Credit Analyst has just come out with their larger forecast here. They had a couple of things that I thought was interesting. They said maybe a 20% of reacceleration of demand could trigger a second wave of inflation, about 20% chance of that. 70% odds still that we go into recession at some point, and they think later in 2024. Boy, we've been saying it for a lot of years, but they're still going for it. And you know, therefore, just a slim chance that we actually have that soft landing, 10% chance maybe. On credit, and I'm skipping a bunch of stuff, but on credit, the current level of corporate spreads is pricing a nearly 50% decline in the default rate over the next 12 months. Such a decline is unlikely, even in a soft landing scenario, and is next to impossible in a recessionary one. I don't know why. I can't imagine why you'd see a 50% decline in the default rate with everything that's going on in the banks, everything that's going on with commercial real estate. I mean, I know we're in an expansionary phase still, but boy, that one doesn't. That one doesn't, it ain't going to get my money out of my wallet on that side of the trade. How about yours?
So what that stat is telling me, what that opinion is telling me, is that they believe that the government spending that it's injecting liquidity into the system can continue and there'll be no ramifications for it. And there already seems to be ramifications for it. And that's what things like gold and Bitcoin are
That's what
showing
gold's
us.
telling you, yeah.
Yeah, that's what gold's telling you. So for them to say, for that, them to have that opinion when I think it's absolute nonsense. I think yesterday was the first number that I looked at, that ADP jobs number, where I thought, okay, that's a pretty decent number. Every other one of the jobs numbers we've seen, including the BLS numbers, I think are nonsense. They're talking about they equate part-time jobs and government jobs and act like they're the same as full-time productive jobs within the economy. I think we're already. I don't think we're in the expansion. Also, if we are in the expansion, you have to throw in the elephant in the room, which is $1 trillion of new debt every 100 days, and that's accelerating. So if we're in an expansion, it's completely government-sponsored expansion, and then the question just becomes, how long can that last? And I don't think it lasts forever.
1 trillion every 100 days.
Yeah, let that roll around a little bit. Right.
1 trillion every. Now, where do you get? Wait a minute. Because we added $500 billion in the fourth quarter by itself last year. That was
now the wall of debt. Now we have to roll over a bunch of new debt and finance it at higher levels. So that's
I'm sorry, I'm making a mistake. My mistake is we added $500 billion. You're talking about just financing $1 trillion every 100 days, right? You're not talking about an extra deficit of $1 trillion every 100 days.
I'm talking about an extra national debt of $1 trillion every 100 days, $3 trillion a year.
Extra national debt every 100 days. So mm-hmm. You're talking about a $3 trillion year in debt this year?
Bingo. Yeah.
Holy crap.
Yeah, it's getting a little scary. And that's, again, when you look at the gold chart, you can see fear. When you looked at the Bitcoin chart, you can see, I think, fear in that too. Of course, there's other factors pushing that around too. But anything, those things to me are no confidence votes in the stewardship of fiat currency, particularly our fiat currency. And that's why those things are screaming. Real estate, absolutely screaming. In my neighborhood, two houses came up for sale, and it's a nice suburban neighborhood. The first two houses came up for sale in like 10 months. They both sold in about a day and a half for about $150,000 more than anyone thought they were worth. There are people scrambling to get into assets from dollars. So it's showing up in real estate and things that hurt when you drop them on your foot.
What's the selling price of a house like that that's going 100 more?
So let's say that's, let's say 15 to 18% more, you know, $1 million houses probably.
$1 million house is going for $1,150,000.
Right. Maybe a little less than that, like a $900,000 house going for $1,050,000.
Okay. But it's okay, fine.
Yeah.
Fine. Okay. Got it. That matters if it was a $500,000 house going for 100 more, or a $2 million.
Of course it does.
Going for 100 more. It's that matters. All right, Jim. So bank credit analyst says that they see the S&P getting to 3,600 in the next recession that they think is a 70% chance this year. What do you do with stocks and as an investor for your long-term stuff? What are you doing here? And we got to go.
So here's what I'm doing. I'm going more into small caps. They just had been beaten down for a while. So the Russell, I'm shifting more. I'm staying long stocks with options protections, but I'm shifting more into the, you know, the commodity names within the stock market as well too. And that I'm very comfortable with that going forward. I do, like I said, I think there's going to be a sharp 8 to 10% correction in the stocks within the next 3 months. And I think that's going to be the thing that pushes the Fed off the sideline and gets them to start cutting. And by the way, that's kind of an historical pattern. The Fed talks about easing, and it's something that actually triggers it, and they get in a little bit of a panic. And again, they talk tough about the stock market declining. They are not tough. We've seen historically when things start to look the slightest bit dicey, they run in on their white horse and throw money at it.
When you say I'm gonna jump here quickly, but when you say small caps in here, that's not to say you don't think they're going to go down when the market goes down either. They go down too, don't they?
Yeah, they do. I like a spread, and I might put on long the Russell, short the Nasdaq, which I'm not sure I'm putting that on yet. That's something I'm kicking around in my head.
Okay. Jim's talking about a sophisticated trade that's appropriate for traders and would not be appropriate for Fred and Ethel or the less sophisticated investor. So caution, folks, Jim is
always
a professional, full-time professional. You want to take the best advice about where you should follow Jim. You should follow Jim Urio to Brant's of Palatine, where you're going to get the best burger you've ever had in your life. Brant's.
Absolutely.
Go to Brant's. Mention the Farcast, you get a 10% discount. All right.
True. I'll actually honor that. Whatever.
I think a couple years ago I said a 20% discount. Some guy showed up.
I think he did. Yes.
Yeah. That was awesome. God bless you, Farcast listeners out there. Yeah. All right. Jim Urio, partner at TJM Institutional Services, our great friend. Thank you, Jim. Ladies and gentlemen, we'll be back with Mahaffey as we figure out what's going on in Washington and around the world. Please stay with us.
Thank you for joining us this week on the Farcast. Now it's time for political analyst Dan Mahaffey and your host, Michael Farr.
Welcome back to the Farcast. It is the fourth day of April. Fourth day of April here as we're starting the second quarter of 2024. Joining me now, as he does every week, Dan Mahaffey from the Dr. Scholl Foundation, also the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress, the senior political analyst on the Farcast. Welcome back, Dan.
Thank you, and good morning, Michael. Great to be talking with you, as always.
Good morning, pal. Let's start in the Middle East this morning and then move to Washington. We're seeing, when we get to Washington, folks, we're seeing polls now where President Biden is trailing President Trump in the polls, and Democrats are getting scared of a Republican sweep. Maybe it's too early, but boy, they're getting nervous. Both sides have lost the left in their parties. I want to talk to Dan about that in just a second, but we're going to start in Israel, Palestine, Gaza Strip. Dan, tell us what's going on there. Chef Jose Andreas, I would even say Saint Jose Andreas of the World Food Kitchen, lost people in their humanitarian effort a couple of days ago. He is saying they were targeted. The president, Biden, is being called on to do something. And he indeed has a call with Netanyahu today. Explain this to us.
Well, thank you, Michael. Yeah, we've seen the tragic events, compounding the misery of the humanitarian crisis in Gaza that these workers for the World Central Kitchen, led by Jose Andres, as you said, a truly a living saint, as close as you can get to it. And we'll get to the politics too of this, because I think he's as close as you can get to Washington's official chef as well. The fact is that you had this strike on the workers. It's halted the humanitarian aid, but it's also led to not only, of course, the United States leadership, but leaders around the world angry with Israel. How could this happen? How could humanitarian workers be hit repeatedly by Israeli drones in vehicles marked as belonging to a food program? So the Israelis, I think, understand the moment of this. You've seen the apologies and promises of investigation, but you also even have questions again about the Israeli conduct of the war. What we see in the Times of Israel, the paper about IDF commanders flouting or relaxing rules of engagement that result in tragedies like this. So you have that discussion going on. I think, though, for Biden, if there is anger about this, the question is, what of this anger results in any policy changes? Because I think for young people, for even independents and Democrats whose support for Israel has been notably flagging recently with this war going on, does this moment break the back of some of this support for Israel? And does it result in real action by Biden? Because I think these people are going to see him even more feckless if his anger is not resulting in a change of course or change of policy towards Israel.
Okay, let's just break down a little more quickly. Do you think somehow that the World Central Kitchen group was indeed targeted? I mean, clearly somebody aimed at that car. You just don't randomly hit a car right in the middle of the roof when there are only three cars driving down the road. Somebody targeted that car. Was that a mistake to target that car? I mean,
it was a mistake to target that car. And it's a question of who was the coordination, who's saying from the commanders responding humanitarian aid, what's on this road, who's telling that to the drone coordinators. And among the commanders of the IDF in this combat zone, it appears there is not that coordination, and you're not going to have a safe environment for civilians or aid workers if your military commanders are operating as free agents.
And your other point is, if Biden goes in and raises hell and stomps his foot and nothing happens, that's a worse result for Biden's image and position, not only in terms of the election and support among a younger cohort, but really around the world. Is that right? I mean,
correct, around the world. And I see, around the world, the support for Israel is already becoming a ball and chain on the U.S. image around the world. They repeatedly talk about in the global South, the hypocrisy of our position on Ukraine vis-a-vis Gaza is what you hear from these leaders and the global South and the public street there. So you have that. You also have, again, the perception of Israel as a democracy, as a moral leader. That is gone now. So what happens on the international stage is already there. At home for these groups, though, you see Biden still getting tens of thousands of uncommitted voters in these primaries protesting his policy.
Yeah. So what has to happen today? Because all I've seen so far, Dan, is the United States saber rattle in support of more peace talks. But in actuality, they're doing nothing other than saying, Israel, we're giving you about as long a rope as we can possibly give you without actually doing anything or supporting a real policy to prevent you from doing anything. So all we've done is given lip service, and you're saying that this can't be lip service. We've reached the point that this can't be lip service. So what does it have to be?
I think it has to be either a real reassessment of what weapons are going to be coming in, levers put on the aid package, like some of the senators have talked about, that there need to be restrictions on aid to Israel.
We're going to cut something. We're going to do something. There's going to be something more than just something real. And not
it's going to be something
show.
Really that you're going to feel rather than just having Anthony Blinken come over and read you the riot act again.
Will Biden do that? Boy, I don't think he's going to do that. Will he do that?
I'm not sure. I think this is a really make or break moment for both his leadership in the region as well as domestically.
The same thing sort of is happening in Israel. There's a lot of opposition sort of in the streets to what Netanyahu is doing. And yet you get the same sense that they still want him to go in and kill everybody in Palestine. They don't care how many others have to die in order to get rid of Hamas. I don't know if it's possible to get rid of Hamas. But is it possible? Where's the level of support for Netanyahu, I guess, is my question.
Well, Netanyahu's facing protests in the streets. There's calls from his own cabinet for an election soon. His political rope is perhaps coming to an end faster than the American support rope you describe. The questions that he has are about, of course, his political scandals and criminal investigations, as well as the conduct of the war. What Israelis, though, I think also are missing is, yes, there is the outrage that, and we cannot forget the outrage of October 7th. It was a horrendous attack by Hamas, and it did provoke an Israeli response. Now, the question with Israel is that, has your response now stooped to the level of barbarism of the group when the world expected more of Israel? And this doesn't justify anything done, but it was, what Israel are we seeing and what behavior are we having? And Israel's always responded muscularly, and that's putting it mildly, to threats to them. And you understand why in their neighborhood. That's also made them useful for us as a security partner. We've also seen them as a moral and democratic partner, but we have to ask hard questions about, are those interests we have in terms of our security, our moral leadership, are those being fulfilled by this strong of a relationship with Israel? And more people are asking that.
So we're asking, you know, how much of an ally and how important is an ally is Israel in that region? How much of a threat is Iran? And why have we not dealt with them more directly? And why do we engage in this sort of a proxy fight with Iran and the Houthis that are allowed to bomb our ships and everything longer, and that we just haven't gone in? Why don't we go after Iran? I don't understand. And when I say I don't understand, I truly don't understand.
Partially now because they probably have some element of nuclear weapons or nearby. So you risk some element of a nuclear
war. And we've watched that happen. We've allowed
it. It's the lesson that North Korea provides too, is just get that nuke and they saw what happened to Gaddafi and Saddam versus those who have nukes. So that's a thing there. But also
doesn't require a Mensa membership, you know.
War with Iran, though, would be like the
problem
Iraq
is
war.
Why the hell did we let it happen?
Well, my returns at Hindsight Capital are off the charts. The factors with Iran, though, are that the policies that could lead to a war, the war with Iran would make the Iraq war, plus this instability we have now, plus war with Hezbollah, plus terrorist attacks in European cities. It would be the kind of conflict that is a World War III starting type scenario. So you don't want to go helter-skelter into it. But what you also acknowledge now is how much more of this is the U.S. responsibility. The threat from Iran, largely to the U.S., would be that it would shut down the Straits of Hormuz. How much of that is a energy market play? And ultimately, how much of this is a question of do the Saudis, the Emiratis, the Qataris, those in the Gulf, do they have the ability to take more of the responsibility for deterring Iran in the long run, too?
Move back to the U.S. A couple of recent polls, Dan, show President Biden trailing President Trump. He had support, and he was ahead in the polls in March. That's eroded very quickly here. And Republicans or Democrats are now fearing a big red wave, as perhaps the Republicans could just win everything behind President Trump. And both are, as I said at the beginning, are losing the lefts in their party. Biden is losing the left wing in his party, and Trump couldn't care less, is delighted to lose the left, more central side of the Republican Party. What does this mean for President Biden? Is it too early to call? He's got plenty of cash. Will the Democrats have something at the convention where they just decide finally, okay, we need a real candidate?
Look, I don't think we're going to have any of those West Wing episodes come to life type of scenarios. What I do think you see, though, is the public is tuning into this. Polls right now, my advice to both Republicans and Democrats is to calm down. It's April. That your perceptions now, there are, you know, we talked about last winter, there were two lifetimes in politics away from the election. Well, now we're about one lifetime in politics away from the election. So there's still plenty of time. The summer events, geopolitics, black swans, they're all out there. Nothing right now suggests to me that either side should be confident of victory, to be honest with you. I see a lot more pitfalls and flaws for each side than I see pathways to victory at this moment. So I think a lot of them need to be taking stock of that and looking at their plans. You talk about for Biden, yes, he's losing the left. I think that affects him where you look at, you know, votes in places like Ann Arbor, Michigan, Madison, Wisconsin. Those are the states where that's going to matter. Trump, though, is losing the suburbs. He's losing suburban voters. He's losing suburban women right now. If you look at the numbers, he's going to try and say that I'll keep you safe. He's trying to make immigration the main issue. But the problem is for him that the counter narrative that comes out, and he's certainly not helped anytime a Southern Supreme Court decides to affirm another abortion ban, that the reproductive and rights issues are going to be the top of the agenda for those folks. So a lot of back and forth to go on. I think the economic story still needs to be evaluated. You know, does interest rate cuts or any of those affect it? I think, you know, Charlie Cook actually said it, I think, really well on Bloomberg, though, that the average swing voter doesn't understand CPI from NCIS. They just understand cost of living.
Dan Mahaffey is the vice chairman of the Dr. Scholl Foundation with the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress, our senior political analyst. Thank you, Dan.
Good to talk to you, Michael.
Right back now with Scott Stroud for segment three. He is director of fixed income for Farmiller in Washington. He's been doing fixed income and managing fixed income institutionally and for individuals for well over 30 years. One of the smartest guys I get to talk to in the business when we come back on the Farcast.
Michael Farr and the Farcast are proud to support Heroes, Inc. Heroes supports the spouses and children of law enforcement officers and firefighters who gave their lives in the line of duty to the greater Washington, D.C. community. Their singular goal is to honor the supreme sacrifice made by these individuals by caring for their families. Heroes' work begins within 24 hours of the tragic loss and continues indefinitely. We invite you to learn more about Heroes' mission at heroes.org. We hope that you will consider supporting Heroes as they endeavor to honor those who protect us. That's heroes.org. Heroes, here for you, here for good. And now, back to the Farcast and your host, Michael Farr. Thank you for joining us on the Farcast. And now, back to your host, Michael Farr.
Welcome back. Joining me now, Farcast fan favorite, the famous, the renowned. And when this man talks, everybody listens. Scott Stroud is a fixed income portfolio manager, senior portfolio manager, head, chief of fixed income at Farr Miller and Washington, joined us in 2020 from Lafayette Investment Partners. He was there for 30 years as a partner. He worked at First American Bank. He's been doing this a while. A go-to guy in the industry, one of the proudest sons of Mount St. Mary's University now. Mount St. Mary's University. Well, lottie da, aren't they putting on airs up at the Mount? Welcome back, Scott.
Thank you, Michael. It's great to be here. And we're going to make bonds interesting today.
Bonds interesting. And you know, Scott, I want to ask you some of the questions that you think people are too afraid to ask a fixed income manager. But let's get a view on rates first. So, ladies and gentlemen, one of the things we're going to do today is I want to ask Scott, if most people get intimidated by fixed income, and if you haven't turned us off already, we're going to go into some of those questions. What do you need to know when you buy a bond or when you buy a treasury bill, or how you should think about money markets? And if the Fed ultimately does start cutting rates here, will this period of 5% sort of money market and T-bill rates just disappear? Will we move back to that 3% or 2% really short-term rates that forces people back into the stock market? Will all of the folks at my age and older no longer be able to get real yields from their savings and their cash accounts anymore? Will we go back to where we were 5 or 6 years ago? I want to get Scott's opinion on that. I mean, if the Fed cuts rates, rates go lower, and that's where we end up. Scott, rates today have been moving up in the past week or so. We're back above that 4.34. We got above 4.4 even on the 10-year Treasury. For old folks who have been doing this a long time, 4.4 still sounds stupidly low on a 10-year Treasury, given the perspective of history here. But we were down at 1% on the 10-year Treasury not that many years ago. How do you look at a 4.3 or 4.4 10% Treasury? How do you make sense of this versus 1%? And look, when I started talking to you in this business, we had treasuries at 8%, 9%, and 10%. So give us some perspective.
I think these highs and lows are very much aberrations of the early 80s and 2020. If you chart these things out since U.S. Treasury has been issuing debt and even longer, 4.3, 4.4 is still a low yield. I bet you it's more of an average over centuries of closer to a 6%, 6.5%. So it's still low. It just seems higher than it was because we kind of got spoiled for a while. And we're smartly higher in yield from the start of the year. And that's as we moved into the year with less confidence that the Fed will be lowering rates and how many times they'll be lowering rates. So
So Treasury bills have still stayed relatively high. The 6-month Treasury is still yielding 5.3%, but that got up to 5.6% or 5.7%. But you can still get 5.3% in a 6-month Treasury bill. 2 years are 4.68. So if the Fed hangs around at this level longer, and they don't cut rates, and all of this is jawboning, and they get a little more nervous about inflation, and they don't want to jump off the high dive too quickly, how long do you think we keep these 5 5.35% 6 month treasury bill rates. Could that be through the end of the year, or do you not see that?
You know, these yields could stay pretty juicy on the front end through the fall, at least. And we are expecting some Fed cuts, and Chair Powell reiterated that yesterday on Fed.
Why are we expecting Fed cuts? Because I don't see a reason for the Fed cuts, given the persistent levels of inflation. I mean, I understand Wall Street keeps demanding Fed cuts, which I think is stupid, because the Fed only cuts when they're worried that the economy is slowing, and the economy is not slowing. Why are we expecting Fed cuts, Scott?
Fed Chair Powell and the rest of the Fed has said these rates are restrictive. Do we need restrictive rates in this economy?
Do you see them as restrictive? I mean, they're restrictive to slow inflation, but they're not killing it. Maybe they're just perfectly restrictive enough to get, you know, the economy growing at the slower 2% rate that the Fed wants.
Well, these could be restrictive by 50 basis points. So by reducing Fed funds by 25 basis points twice, you could still just barely be restrictive or non-restrictive. And the economy can do just fine. It continues to do very well. But that is the question. Do we need restrictive rates right now? Whether inflation seems to be going in the correct direction.
What do you think? One, do you think rates are restrictive right now? You've watched this economy thing for a long time. Are these rates high enough to be slowing the economy materially?
They are restrictive enough to slow the economy. Borrowing costs are up. I wouldn't say they're punitive, but borrowing costs up for corporations.
And I suppose inflation has come down materially. Listen, folks, part of it was that there was some cyclicality to the inflation we were seeing pushed by supply chain problems during COVID. But those higher rates certainly are slowing inflation. And the question is, are they slowing it enough? So to the extent, are they restrictive? Yes. Evidence is they've slowed it. So the economy's slowing. And the fear here, folks, is that they are high enough that the economy will really slow, that the brakes have been applied, the car is slowing, and we say, oh, we like it at this speed. And what we're not recognizing is that we haven't taken our foot off the brake, and it's still slowing and still slowing. So do we have, you know, my grandmother, as she got older, used to drive with 2 feet because she couldn't move her feet fast enough. Imagine all those, you know, other octogenarians out there who are doing that today. That happens a lot here in Florida, with 1 foot on the gas and 1 foot on the brake, right? Did your grandmother do that? Do you ever remember your grandfather, 1 foot on the gas, 1 foot on the brake, just to make sure they could get the balance right? That's what the Fed's doing in many ways. There was plenty of gas out there. They still want the economy to move. They've got an interest in the gas pedal, but they've put more pressure on the brake. Do they have it just right? What do you think, Scott? Just right?
I think they do have it just right. The economy, you know, jobs are plentiful. Wages are still increasing as well as prices are increasing. I think the economy's in a good place. That's my contention, is economy's in a good place. Inflation is slowly decreasing. Do we need to keep them restrictive? I don't think so.
Okay. I've been told, now here are questions for the bond guy. I've been told by my financial planner at Farr Miller in Washington that I should have 30 or 40% of my portfolio in fixed income. How long bonds should I buy? You're going to buy bonds for me. How do you know? Should you be buying the 30 years? I don't know whether I should buy a 30 year. I don't know if I should buy that 6 month bill. That 6 month bill Michael just talked about at 5.35%. That sounds pretty good. Why would I ever want to buy a 4.3 10 year when I can get 5.35 on 6 months, Scott? And what question should I ask the bond guy? Start with that one, though, for me.
Well, the concern is reinvestment risk. It's all rosy right now. 6 months from now, when that bond bill matures, rates could be 4%.
Oh, because the Fed's going to lower those short rates.
And you're painting yourself into a box. You made a market call. You said, heck, I'm going to take this 5.30 for 6 months. And look what you did. We like a laddered approach. Yields, you might get lower yields, but if you buy some year bills, some 6 month bills, twos, threes, fours out to 2030, 31, a nice little intermediate ladder. It's a great way to insulate yourself from interest rate swings, highs and lows, without extending your duration or your average maturity.
So if I've got to have 30% of my portfolio in bonds because that's what my financial planner says I need to maintain stability over time, you're going to design a portfolio and a shorter term or intermediate term ladder that's going to give me yield and some stability over time. And if I go for just the higher paying yields, I could end up looking up one morning in 6 months or 9 months and see the prevailing rate of interest on those bills, meaning the 6 month bill could all of a sudden be at 3% when my 5.3 is maturing. And all I'm going to get is 3%. And by the way, I can no longer get the 4.4% that Scott locked his other people in, was able to lock in just 6, 9 months ago. Have I got that right, Scott?
And then the biggest fear is, look what you did. Now you're looking at a 3 and you're barely beating inflation. So that is the worst thing you can do. We're trying to do better than inflation. Don't make a market call.
We're drawing a difference here and highlighting a difference for those long-term investors who have a long-term strategy that they need some fixed income to mitigate volatility, because as folks particularly get older and they can't replace income and they near retirement, they need the stability. Everybody thinks that risk is okay. Listen to me, ladies and gentlemen. Everybody thinks risk is just fine when things are going up. When things start going down and the stock market falls 20% and your bond portfolio hasn't budged, think about this. You've got 30% in bonds and 70% in stocks. Stock market falls 20%. You're down 14%. And your bonds are fine. Okay? So you're mitigating the risk by limiting your exposure to the more volatile asset class, which is stocks, and you've got an anchor in your bond portfolio. That's Scott's job, is to go out there then and try and figure this market out. I also want to say that people often want to know, Scott, should they buy a tax-free bond or should they just buy the Treasury even though they pay tax on it? I mean, if they can get a 5% yield on a treasury, how does that compare to a 3.5% yield on a tax-free? Which one should I buy?
Most important thing is to know your tax rate, your federal rate, your state and local rate. But if you're getting 5% on a treasury, 30% tax bracket, you're going to net out about a 3% or so. And that
3.5%, right? So if I've got a 5% treasury and a 30% tax bracket, 3 times 5, 15, 1.5 minus 5 gives me 3.5% yield. So they're basically, that would be 3.5 as a taxable equivalent yield to a 5% taxable. Is that fair? So that math works, right? So if
That's
I could
correct.
Buy a 4% tax-free, I'm really ahead of the game, right? That's 80% of treasuries.
And you've locked it in, not just for 6 months.
Oh, yeah, that would be good, too, if you could extend that as a longer maturity. What keeps, Scott, we got to go. What keeps you awake at night? Anything worrying you these days? Any concerns as the experienced bond manager?
Everything. That's a sign of a good bond manager. skepticism is tantamount. Really, the debt. U.S. Treasury debt, the amount of it coming is really a landslide of debt that's coming our way. And so far, it's been an orderly market. It's been handled okay, but at a certain point, some of these auctions are going to get sloppy, and we're talking tens of billions of dollars, hundreds of billions of dollars, and that's real money. And what happens when demand declines, prices go down. So that's another factor that can really impact longer yields.
Scott Stroud is head of fixed income at Farr Miller in Washington. And I am so privileged to be able to talk with him and pick his brain. Not only is he just smart as hell, you can't tell it from this forecast, but he is funny as hell. He's got a wicked sense of humor, as do a lot of bond managers. Some of them are actually just deadly boring, but you'll find a lot of folks in this business are wickedly funny. He is one of them. So are, by the way, pathologists and many funeral directors. There's a theme there. Sooner or later, they got to be funny. Stroud is actually very funny and a wonderfully nice man. Scott, thanks so much for all you do for all of our clients and for being such a nice guy and helping us on the Farcast today.
Pleasure, Michael. Thank you.
That's it for another Farcast, ladies and gentlemen, as we cover Wall Street, Washington, and the world, bringing you insiders from around the globe, around the country, to help us with our perspective, our understanding, our knowledge, so we can figure out the world around us, particularly our economy and our investing thesis, our investing discipline. So stay disciplined. Emotion is the foe of the long-term investor. We'll be back again next week and do it all again for you. Thank you. On behalf of Harry Jennings, everybody at Hightower and Farr Miller in Washington, please share us on social media. Have a great weekend. I'm Michael Farr.
Thanks for being with us this week on the Farcast. We hope you enjoy the show as much as we enjoy making it for you. Thanks to our guest, Jim Murio, Dan Mahaffey, and special guest, Scott Stroud. Farcast is produced by Michael Farr and Harry Jennings and comes to you weekly for free on all major podcast platforms, including Spotify, TuneIn, and Apple Podcasts. Please be aware that anytime we or any of our guests mention a specific company, sector, or refer to performance in relation to an earnings report, headline, or economic trend, it's not a recommendation to buy or sell. Review the risks and rewards of any investment with your financial advisor for what specific investment and general strategy is appropriate for you before you make any investment decision. And as always, we could be of assistance at Farr Miller in Washington. Please reach out to me at hjennings@farrmiller.com. We are here to help, and I'm happy to arrange for any of our listeners an appointment with one of our financial professionals to review your portfolio, your needs, and your goals. We love reading all of your notes, and we try to reply to as many as we can. You can reach us at hjennings@farrmiller.com. Let us know any questions you have about past episodes or questions you'd like us to address in upcoming shows. Please subscribe and share the show, and we'll be back with you next week. Our schedule in coming weeks includes Dr. Jay Bryson, Chief Economist of Wells Fargo, and fan favorite Jenny Harrington. Take care, stay safe, and stay healthy. Thanks for listening to the Farcast. Wall Street, Washington, and the world. Farr Miller in Washington is a group comprised of investment professionals registered with Hightower Advisors, LLC, an SEC-registered investment advisor. Some investment professionals may also be registered with Hightower Securities, LLC, member FINRA and SIPC. Advisory services are offered through Hightower Advisors, LLC. Securities are offered through Hightower Securities, LLC. All information referenced herein is from sources believed to be reliable. Farr Miller in Washington and Hightower Advisors, LLC have not independently verified the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this podcast. Farr Miller in Washington and Hightower Advisors, LLC and any of its affiliates make no representations or warranties, expressed or implied, as to the accuracy or completeness of the information or for statements or errors or omissions or results obtained from the use of this information. Farr Miller in Washington and Hightower Advisors, LLC and any of its affiliates assume no liability or any action made or taken in reliance on or relating in any way to the information. This podcast and the materials contained herein were created for informational purposes only. The opinions expressed are solely those of the authors and do not represent those of Hightower Advisors, LLC or any of its affiliates. Farr Miller in Washington and Hightower Advisors, LLC or any of its affiliates do not provide tax or legal advice. This material was not intended or written to be used or presented in any way to any entity as tax or legal advice. Clients are urged to consult their tax and/or legal advisors for related questions.